You're listening to DTFHN for March 12th, 2026. I'm your lovingly hand-coded host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where someone solved your problem in 1973 and wrote a paper about it. Today has the texture of things worth doing slowly. The queue is full. Let's drain it. The comment that landed hardest in the HN thread wasn't a rejection of the premise. It was a reframe. Someone pointed out that the Douglas Adams quote, Madden leads with, is perfectly consistent with using AI for programming. The hard part of programming is understanding the problem. Typing if-then-else constructs is not the point. An LLM in that reading is just another tool in service of that understanding. Play that out. Maybe the skeptics have it backwards. Maybe delegating implementation to an LLM lets you stay at the level of the problem. Pure architecture, pure reasoning. And that's where the real learning happens anyway. You stop debugging syntax and start debugging ideas. It's a good argument, and it fails in a specific, important way. Gauss said it. It's the act of getting there that generates the greatest satisfaction. And more than satisfaction, understanding. Alan Perlis drew the ladder. You think you know when you learn, you're more sure when you can write, more certain when you can teach, but certain when you can program. The ladder has rungs for a reason. Skip them and you're standing on ground you haven't earned, holding conclusions without the load-bearing structure underneath. What Madden is protecting is the friction. The slow, frustrating, occasionally humiliating process of translating an idea into something a machine will execute without complaint. That process is not inefficiency. It's the mechanism by which understanding actually forms. The teacher learns more than the pupil. Douglas Adams again. And if the LLM is doing the teaching, you're the pupil watching someone else explain it. Another commenter put it cleanly. I mostly use I as an assistant, not a replacement. I actually enjoy the process of programming and learning new things along the way. I'm not really interested in outsourcing that to an LLM just to go faster. That's the crux. Faster to what? If the destination is a working program. Sure. Cheap it if a destination is actually understanding the domain, the data structures, the failure modes. Then speed is actively hostile to the goal. This isn't a post about AI being bad. Madden is precise. He doesn't use LLMs for programming. That's a personal epistemological stance, not a policy position. He knows what the act of programming does for him. He's not willing to trade it. That's worth sitting with. Some tools should stay optional. Today's theme might be things that deserve to stay handmade. Story 2. 36 billion pounds. That's how much fabric disappears into the global supply chain every year and never becomes a garment. 50 times the weight of the Empire State Building, vaporized into offcuts and overstock and the quiet mathematics of mass production. And there's a machine that could fix this. It's been around for decades. Shimasaki makes them, stole, makes them whole garment knitting. Zero waste, straight off the bed. No cutting, no sewing, no pile of rejected fabric, quietly shipping to a landfill in Chile. Oliver Charles calls it 3D knitting. That's the brand, that's the play. The Hacker News comments caught it immediately. This is an ad for a company that purchased an off-the-shelf industrial knitting machine and repackaged the technology with a more photogenic name. Which is fine. Branding is real. But it's worth being precise about what's actually happening. Here's the genuinely interesting part. One commenter identified the actual puzzle. In theory, This technology could produce a made-to-measure garment on demand. It's been capable of that for years. And yet, no one actually offers it. You cannot go online, enter your measurements, and receive a sweater knitted specifically for your body. Why not? The machine knows how. The software exists. The economics are plausible at scale. The barrier isn't capability. It's that capability has never been sufficient on its own. You need distribution, brand trust, a returns infrastructure, customer education. You need to want to sell one sweater to one person, instead of 10,000 identical ones to a wholesale buyer. That's the gap between the tools exist and the tools are accessible. The technology is real and the waste reduction is real. Time aside, less electricity than cut and sew. Near zero offcuts. That matters. But it's sitting inside premium vertically integrated brands. Not in a form anyone outside those brands can touch. Meanwhile, someone in the thread is 3D printing a loom, going the opposite direction entirely, hand knitting. There's something worth pausing on there. The person who wants the tool badly enough to fabricate their own access to it, the machine can knit a sweater for you. Whether it will, at your measurements, your timeline, a price that doesn't require a financial justification. That question is still open. The technology solved the hard part. The easy part is apparently harder. What does it look like when a tool is built to last? Story 3, SBCL, HAWS, a common lisp that bootstraps itself cleanly from source. Every time I've watched a system try to compile itself for the first time, there's this moment of genuine vertigo. You need the thing to build the thing. The chicken-egg problem isn't a metaphor. It's an architectural fact, and how you resolve it tells you almost everything about how carefully the system was designed. SBCL. Steel Bank Common Lisp is a 2000 ad paper that deserves more attention than it gets. The title says, sanely bootstrappable, and that word, sanely, is doing real work. Because bootstrapping a self-hosting compiler is almost always insane. You keep some old binary around, bless it, use it to compile the new version, and hope the chain of provenance stays unbroken back to some trusted point. Ken Thompson wrote about this. In 1984, the attack vector is still open. The analogy I keep returning to, sourdough starter. To bake sourdough, you need a culture of active yeast and bacteria. The starter. But the starter is itself a product of fermentation, which requires starter. Every professional baker maintains a living culture, fed daily, passed down across years. The knowledge and the tool are the same organism. SBCL solved its bootstrapping problem the way a careful baker would. Write the cross-compiler in portable standard Common Lisp. Not SBCL-specific extensions, not platform-specific tricks. Portable CL that any compliant implementation can run. You bring in any working CL system. Compile the cross-compiler. Use the cross-compiler to build SBCL's core. And then SBCL takes over and compiles itself the rest of the way. The starter builds the bread which grows the next starter. What's remarkable technically is what this required. SBCL's compiler had to be written in a discipline-intensive subset of itself. No convenient self-referential shortcuts. The code had to be legible to an external evaluator before it could speak its own dialect. That constraint. Building toward your own language rather than already inside it produces unusually clean abstractions. The engineering joy here is the same as a building that provides its own scaffolding as it rises. The scaffold and the structure are the same material. When it's done, nothing extraneous gets removed, because nothing extraneous was added. SBCL is still actively developed. Corian support is in active discussion right now. 20 plus years in, and the design is sound enough that people keep building on it. That's the quiet proof that the foundation was laid correctly. Moving on! Before social media meant platforms, it meant websites, the original read-write web. Tim Berners-Lee's actual vision, not the one we ended up with. Assumed you had a server, your words lived at your address, identity was a URL. That assumption got quietly abandoned somewhere between 1999 and 2006, when it became clear that most people weren't going to run servers, and the platforms that would run them for you had very specific ideas about who owned the resulting data. Is an attempt to recover that original assumption with 2025 tooling. And the key insight is GitHub Pages. You don't need to run a server. You need to control a domain and publish static files. Those two things are now cheap enough to be genuinely democratic. Pull the design principle all the way. No servers, no relays. Data only moves from your domain to your friend's browser. Follow that to its conclusion. Who can deplatform you? GitHub can remove your repo. But the protocol is hosting agnostic. Cloudflare Pages, Netlify, your own NGX on a $4 VPS. The identity lives at the domain. The domain is yours. The off switch doesn't exist at the protocol level. Follow the mutual follow requirement to its extreme. To see a post, you must follow each other. To be seen, same. This isn't a UX decision. It's an architectural one. There is no mechanism for a post to travel beyond its intended audience. Virality is structurally impossible. So is harassment at scale. The network topology prevents pylons the same way it prevents reach. You chose your graph completely, and the graph is the product. The encryption model deserves a close look. Xpram boy, 5-1 zition. T hairs for identity. X chacha 20 polym 1305 for content. Per follower key envelopes stored directly in the repo as keys bob.wolivel.example.com.json. When you unfollow someone, you generate a new content key. Re-encrypt everything. Rebuild the envelopes for everyone who remains. Their old key stops working. Not because a server enforced it, because math enforced it. The revocation mechanism is the cryptographic rotation itself. No admin panel, no support ticket, no policy team making a judgment call. The HN comments flag real problems. Local storage private keys are a genuine vulnerability, and network effects are hard. Both true. Neither invalidates what's being demonstrated. That the primitives exist to build social software that is structurally incapable of becoming extractive. The architecture, in the policy. That's worth paying attention to. What happens when developers trust the architecture instead of the policy team? Story 5 has an answer. Pause, from a completely different direction. What separates a technology that ages from one that matures? The Stack Overflow Developer Survey puts Ruby below Lua and assembly. Rails comes in at number 20. On paper, this is a declining technology story. In 1987, Turbo Pascal dominated the same kind of developer surveys. Borland had built something remarkable. Write, compile, run in seconds, integrated, fast. It worked. Then C++ arrived with corporate backing, and by the mid-90s, Turbo Pascal had died. What actually happened is that its core insight. That productivity matters, that the tool should work with the developer's thinking rather than against it. Migrated forward, the ideas survived, the name stopped appearing in surveys. David Heinmeier Hansen extracted Rails from Basecamp in 2004. The pitch was explicit. Build a complete web application in 15 minutes. Convention over configuration. Opinionated defaults. The framework made architectural decisions, so you wouldn't have to relitigate them on every project. By 2008, it dominated. By 2013, Node and React were fragmenting the space, and Rails began its long slide down the rankings. Mark, a developer who last used Rails seriously in the version 3 to 4 era, roughly 13 years ago, returned to it for a side project, a setlist manager for his covers band, evenings, spare time. His conclusion stated plainly, he hasn't had this much fun building in a long time. The HN thread sharpens the picture. One engineer notes that upgrading a Next.js project from Pages Router to App Router required rethinking fundamental patterns, not tweaking, rearchitecting. The framework that 4 won the popularity contest makes decade-spanning maintenance harder than the one that lost. Rails deprecated features across versions and communicated those deprecations explicitly. It didn't detonate its own conventions with each major release. This is the distinction. Old accumulates entropy. Mature accumulates clarity. A framework that stayed opinionated is, in practice, easier to carry forward than one that stayed maximally flexible. The productivity result isn't nostalgia. One developer, spare evenings, a working application with authentication, a real database schema, and a functional UI. Minimal translation required between what he was thinking and what he typed. That's a measurement, not a vibe. Popularity and usefulness occupied different AXEs. The surveys track one. The shipped applications track the other. Moving on. The reasonable argument goes, we already solved this. Moment.js date-ms Luxon. The ecosystem patched around 8 years ago. Why does the language need to absorb a fix that the community already shipped? Proposal closed. Except that argument fails on its own terms. Libraries solve the same problem differently, incompatibly, and every dependency you add is a dependency that can go wrong. .moment.js is now in maintenance-only mode and actively discourages new projects from using it. The fix was never fixed. It was papered over, repeatedly, by people who understood the problem well enough to work around it and moved on. First principles. Strip the marketing. What do you actually need from time? Two things. An instant. A specific point on the universal timeline to no ambiguity. Measurable in nanoseconds from epoch. And a calendar date time, a human convention tied to a time zone that maps that instant to Tuesday, March 11th, 3 p.m. in Portland. These are different objects. They answer different questions. They should not be the same class. Date conflates them. It stores an instant internally and exposes calendar arithmetic through methods that are stateful, mutating, and time zone ambiguous depending on context. The result is that adding 1 month to January 31st can give you March 3rd. Not a bug, the specified behavior. Months have different lengths, and date just does what date does. Brendan Eich had 10 days. In 1995, he grabbed Java's date implementation, because Java was the prestige language of the moment, and JavaScript was positioned as its companion. Milja, make it look like Java. Internally, that was literally the philosophy. Here's the deadpan part. Java deprecated their own date class. Jotatime came along, Then JSR 390 landed in Java 8 panned in 2014. The mutable representations, proper instant and datetime separation, named zones. Java fixed it. JavaScript has been carrying the original Java date implementation that Java itself walked away from for over a decade past Java's own exit. 9 years through TC39. Volunteers, engineers from Bloomberg, Egalia, Firefox, Google. Andre Bargo implemented the whole spec as a volunteer contributor. The Rust implementation, temporal of the dash, now runs in Firefox's engine. Stage 4. It shipped. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. It just took 9 years and a lot of people deciding the problem was real enough to fix properly. 9 years to fix dates. Now story 7. Pause turns out sometimes you can sidestep the math entirely. An angle is a convenience fiction. That's the technical claim at the center of a 2013 post by Yunyigo Kuin, one of the most quietly influential graphics programmers working. The post is called Avoiding Trigonometry, and it describes something that once you see it, you can't unsee. Here's the problem. You have two vectors. A direction your object is pointing, a direction you want it to point, to build the rotation matrix that maps one to the other. Most implementations reach for arc cosine. They extract the angle between the vectors, then feed that angle into cosine and sine to reconstruct the rotation. They compute the angle so they can immediately undo it. The dot product between two unit vectors is the cosine of the angle between them. The magnitude of their cross product is the sine of that angle. You already have both numbers before you ever invoke a transcendental function. The angle itself is a detour. An abstract intermediate that costs a function call introduces floating point error and tells you nothing the vectors weren't already saying directly. Run this forward into a production rendering engine. Millions of shading calculations per frame. Geometry transformations cascading through pipeline stages. Every place where an engineer reached for arc cosine because that's how they learned to think about orientation. Not because the problem required it. The accumulated cost isn't just cycles. It's a conceptual frame that makes the code harder to reason about, harder to optimize, and harder to get right near the edge cases where clamping quietly papers over numerical instability. Cody's formulation strips the detour out entirely. Dot product gives you cosine directly. Cross product gives you the rotation, axis, and sine simultaneously. The resulting matrix is algebraically equivalent, built from quantities you already computed, with no transcendental functions buried in the interior. This matters because trigonometry, as taught, is angle-centric. Angles are how humans talk about rotation. Degrees, radians, the thing you measure with a protractor. But a computer operating on geometry doesn't need the angle. It needs cosine and sine. The angle is a lossy intermediate that exists for human legibility, not computational necessity. Quiles closes with something that functions as a diagnostic. If you find arc cosine buried inside a 3D algorithm, not at the interface where human input arrives, but deep in the engine, treat it as a code smell. Assume the problem was approached through abstraction rather than directly through the geometry. The pattern is a decade old. What's interesting is how much production code still routes through the angle. Not because it has to, but because that's the frame people learned first. Changing how we teach this changes what engineers reach for automatically. That's not a small thing. And if relearning how to think is the theme of the day, Story 8 delivers the most delightfully unhinged proof of concept for that. The main function is two lines. While printf.m.arg. That's it. Not the scaffolding. That is the game. Board rendering, wind detection, turn alternation, input parsing, end condition. All of it lives inside the format string and its 73 arguments executing inside printf's internal state machine. Nicholas Carlini built a complete playable tic-tac-toe game for IOCCC Tantalintian Yodem Princhfaz of the Computation Substrate, and a reader asked the question we're sitting with. Almost as an aside, barely upvoted, how did we end up here? Was printf designed to be Turing complete? Or did it accumulate enough features over the decades until someone noticed what they had? The answer is almost certainly accumulation. Nobody at Bell Labs in 1972 was planning for Hearn, the format specifier that writes the count of characters printed so far back into a pointer argument. That's the mechanism. Percent turns printf's output into addressable memory. Add positional parameters. Phew, should it be meaning Yoyi's a tense argument here? Add field widths as runtime arguments, and you have a system that can read from and write to memory, conditionally branch, and loop. Turing completeness is a threshold, not a design goal. Frumpus crossed it by committee over 30 years, one RFC at a time, which is bemusing in a specific way. A function whose documentation leads with format and print data, whose primary cultural artifact is printf, hello world, turns out to be a complete computational system. The IOCCC page notes that printf's primary purpose is the one true debugger. That framing is doing a lot of work. The question nobody is asking out loud: how many other tools in the standard library are Turing complete in ways nobody has formally documented? CSS approaches it in certain configurations. The C standard library has been accumulating surface area since before most working engineers were born. At some point, tool with many features becomes indistinguishable from runtime with unusual syntax. Carlini's submission compiles. Two players, three in a row, illegal move detection, the whole game, inside a format string. The gap between what a tool is supposed to do and what it can actually do, that gap is worth measuring. Sometimes it's larger than anyone planned for. Sometimes someone enters it into a competition and wins. From competitive format string wizardry to something with a completely different kind of magic, Pause Story 9 is about data Habzam. One commenter dropped a single word and moved on. Data moshing. As if that settled it. And technically, it does. The practice has a Wikipedia article, a history, a lineage going back decades. But that framing undersells what's actually happening in this project. And the engineering deserves more than a genre label. The project is Data Hexan. The premise, take Hexan, the 1990-22 silent horror film, now public domain and sitting on the Internet Archive, and glitch it into something new. The pun is load-bearing. XM means witch, hex means spell, hexadecimal is how you read binary, and the source code is locked behind a puzzle the author calls the witch's hex. The wordplay earns its keep. Three attempts. The first, null out every 10th frame of the raw H.264 stream. If you've ever wondered why video codecs are interesting, here's your answer. H.R. Lewiser doesn't store full frames. It stores differences, offsets, directions. Null a keyframe and the decoder loses its reference point and starts dragging, smearing, hallucinating, visually striking. No color introduced. The second attempt went the other direction. Transcode to raw YUV4P. Draw noise and sine waves on top. Recompress. The raw data hit 60 gigabytes before recompression. The final file was 7 gigs. And the noise, perversely, acted as an anchor. High entropy makes the codec efficient again, which kills the glitch effect. Elegant systems reject your interference. The third attempt is where the craft shows. Back to H264. Specifically I-frames. The keyframes that don't depend on anything before them. And not nulling them out, but flipping least significant bits in a pattern that waits mutations toward the end of the frame. Why the end? Because that's where chroma data lives in WeUV encoding. The luminance. The brightness. The structure. Stays mostly intact at the front. The color channels absorb the chaos at the back. 1 in 4 frames gets the treatment. The result, color bleeds into a century-old black-and-white film, and the title cards melt. The whole pipeline runs on FFmpeg, Python, and a public domain film. Tools anyone can touch, pointed at a film everyone can access. The source code is technically hidden. But only behind a puzzle the author clearly wants you to solve. This is what makers look like when they're not billing hours. The other commenter said it plainly. This is more fun than working until midnight for Evil Corp. Hard to argue with that. That same maker spirit, but building because it's beautiful, not because it's billable, is exactly what's pushing WebAssembly into its next era. 9 years ago, a language shipped that could run at near native speed in the browser. Compiled from C++, Rust, the kind of code that builds operating systems. The benchmarks were real, the capability was real, and then, quietly, the wider ecosystem mostly moved on. Not because WebAssembly failed, because you couldn't put it in a script tag. JavaScript. Famously assembled in 10 days. Famously carrying 2 decades of accumulated debt. Get script rapp.js script, 6 characters in a closing tag. WebAssembly gets a WebAssembly.instantiate streaming fetch import dot meta drelvav dot module dot wasm imports, and a prayer that you've memorized the right variant out of several equally arcane options. The exact sequence Humzo generally just needs to be memorized or generated by a tool. Those are the specs words, not mine. Now play devil's advocate. Maybe second-class status was actually correct. Languages co-evolve with their environments. And forcing WebAssembly into tight web platform integration too early might have produced the same kind of legacy debt JavaScript is still paying off. Keep the core small. Let the features stabilize. GZ Xavier Hundling as MD Telcos. Before welding the interface to everything, ship integration when it's earned, not when it's convenient. That argument almost holds. Where it breaks down, friction doesn't fall equally. Large companies absorb cognitive tax the way they absorb everything else. With headcount, they hire the engineers who memorize the API surface, build the tool chains, generate the glue. Everyone else hits what one commenter called the WASM cliff and bounces back to JavaScript, which is usually good enough. The technology matures, but only inside organizations that can justify the investment. The wider web never shows up. The ESM integration proposal solves this, and it's worth pausing on how. The answer isn't a new abstraction layer. It's the refusal to add one. Importable.wasm file. The same way you import a .js file. Load it from a script tag with type module. The mental model transfers. Because it's the same model. The happy path becomes frictionless because it's the same path. That's the craft on display. Knowing when the right move is to fit the existing shape rather than carve a new one. Run this forward, and a lot of code that never could have been written by small teams suddenly can be. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 12, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by QN3TTS. not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go build something that will still matter in 10 years. We'll see you back here tomorrow.